Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Narcissism Dakota, a podcast that takes a comprehensive look at the various facets of narcissism from different psychoanalytic perspectives. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Mazzella. The title of today's episode is A Late to a Race, Decoding the Blueprint of Narcissistic Relationship Dynamics, Part 2. In this episode, I will try to demonstrate how I work with someone who engages in omnipotent narcissistic object relations. I will give some details on the process of change. In other words, what's necessary to help someone move from a narcissistic way of relating to a more loving relationship. This is part two. If you haven't had the opportunity to listen to part one, this is a good time to go and check that out. A few important takeaway points from part one, just to set some groundwork for today. First, the most important and defining characteristic of the narcissist, in my opinion, is the omnipotent structure, the grandiose sense of self. Since this is such an important part of what holds the narcissist together, in this two-part series, I thought it would be valuable to look at how this plays a role in their relationships. In part one, I attempted to demonstrate how narcissistic individuals must return over and over to this narcissistic, omnipotent object relationship. I described, by way of three simple examples, the process of what is referred to in this day and age. This is what we call love bombing, and then devaluation and hoovering. That's the process that's typically described in the social media content that I reviewed. But in psychoanalytic terms, I translated this in the love bombing into the idealized self and other, which is, and you may have heard me say this in prior episodes, that's the blissful, magical union, which is characteristic of the earlier symbolic stage, or what's also referred to as the narcissistic stage of early development. And the reason the narcissist so typically returns to this stage of development is because it was interrupted too abruptly and prematurely. In my social media content review, I heard that the devaluing phase may happen because the narcissist gets bored with the narcissistic supplies that are offered in the relationship. But in part one, I added to, and hopefully I enriched our understanding by way of three examples, all of which demonstrated, I thought, that something happens to create the relationship shift. In other words, the relationship shifts from elate to erase. In other words, overvaluing, glorifying, to erasing, to devaluing, right? In each example, there was a separation that went on, but it was unnoticed. And the term separation was widened to include anything from a different opinion, in the case of a wife who gave some advice to her husband on a home improvement project, to the end of a long weekend trip with her husband, and finally to a patient who needed to see me as being emotionally unavailable. So all of these were examples of separation that went unnoticed, which in my opinion, oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes accounts for the shift from the love bombing, the magical union, to the devaluation. To further understand the omnipotent narcissistic object relation, I was about to introduce another concept borrowed from psychoanalytic thinking of the omnipotently incorporated object. And by the way, just a little bit more review. The concept omnipotent narcissistic object relation, I just want to break it down quickly to make sure that we're all on the same page. Omnipotent is that grandiose sense of self that I mentioned earlier. That's the structure that holds the narcissist together and differentiates them from other personality disorders. Narcissistic, obviously, we know that one. An object relation, we call it object relation because they're not relating to another person as a whole object. In other words, they relate to people as what we call part objects, which are need gratifying objects. Someone that's there to gratify a need. Okay. So when the object is omnipotently incorporated, the self becomes so identified with the incorporated object that almost, not all, but almost all separate identity or any boundary between the self and the other is denied. And this is what's called the love bombing stage. The love bombing stage is designed to erase separation. That's why there are constant text messages, calls, attempts to see, loving gestures, gifts. The person on the recipient of this doesn't have an opportunity to breathe, to think. And that's the point. So that there's this magical union between the two of them. So this is the individual who says, in the example I gave earlier, give me all the answers. I don't know. When you ask them a question, I don't know. In other words, take care of me. Think for me. If someone says, can you plan a date? And the fellow says, I don't know what to do. In other words, take care of this. Now, that's a little bit different than the love bombing, but you could see how the other is, it's designed for the other to take up certain functions that the narcissist is not willing to do. With any recognition that the other is important to him or her, or separate from them, with their own opinions or perspectives on the household project, like I mentioned a moment ago, the narcissist becomes enraged and they enter into the devaluing state and they turn you into a nothing. That's the erase in the title of this episode, a late to erase. But the erase comes at a very significant point when there's a separation. This, however, when the erase comes into effect, leaves them feeling abandoned again, which that's exactly what they're trying to avoid. They try to avoid the separation. The separation feels like an abandonment, like an abuse. So it's re-traumatizing them. But at least now it's on their terms, right? So finally, what they will do to ward off any recognition of separation, they must reconstitute the narcissistic omnipotent object relation. And this is what's referred to as the hoovering stage. They need to suck you back in, right? But really what they need to do is avoid the abandonment. They need to avoid the separation. And this is sort of a bit of a digression, but I want to make it clear that from what I listen to, and the social media content, this all seems like a motivated act, almost as if this is consciously acted out by the narcissist. And I want to say more often than not, sometimes it is, of course. And that's a different type of, remember, there are all different types of narcissism. And that's a different type. But the majority of, at least the narcissists that have been in my life, this is not always so intentional. And not always so much at their conscious level of awareness. So when they're sucking you back in, right, to erase any level of separation, there's a demand to be loved. And in my field, this is what we call narcissistic entitlement and greedy incorporation of what the individual feels they've been denied. So they feel like this has been denied and they're entitled to it. And they're going to get it. The omnipotent narcissistic object relation, therefore, it does away with any feelings that are caused by frustration or any awareness of envy or of envy. So this is what you typically hear or you see on social media. It's this feeling of we are so great, she's amazing, we're a team. We had the best vacation. Look at all the pictures. It's the most amazing experience ever. However, once there's any sign, any indication of separateness, for instance, she wants to make a decision without him, or as I mentioned in part one, a suggestion on how he can complete a home renovation project, immediately he begins to question her decision and shows her how this is not a good decision, or he needs to be overly involved with every decision because he doesn't want to be left out. And he'll even start accusing her of not working as a team. Why? Because she should not have a mind of her own. Having a mind of your own is a level of separation. Having an opinion on your own is a degree of separation. And that becomes painfully intolerable to these individuals. So I just want to go back to one more thing. In episode one, I said something like this. Here's the most important point. When narcissistic, omnipotent self-idealization diminishes, or when the omnipotent self is challenged, the individual becomes aware of his need and dependency on the other, her husband or his wife in the aforementioned examples. Dependence on another implies, and again, this could be something as easy as, like, simple as accepting somebody's support. That's dependence. Dependence implies love for and recognition of the value of the other person. And this creates a great deal of pain. Pain because in their mind of the inevitable frustrations and the consequences that come along with the recognition that somebody is valuable and that you depend on them. You know they're going to frustrate you. How do you know that? How do you know that they're going to be frustrated? Is because it's happened before. And if it's happened before, it will happen again. Remember, again, in part one, but a quick review, I went into the origins of this omnipotent way of relating. And one of the things that we've discovered in the childhood history is that there are many experiences of these individuals who had constant or chronic childhood disappointments or absences that were too long. And the baby feels, and I use the word breast again as always symbolically to mean comforting or care or holding, understanding. But the baby feels that the comforting, they're being deprived of it. In other words, somebody is keeping all the comforting pleasures away from them. And if the baby sees the caregiver as being mean and withholding, then what we begin to see is an increase in destructive fantasies. I want to really emphasize this point. It is not just deprivation that the child experiences, just like it's not a different opinion, but that in their mind, they are under attack. And therefore, a counterattack, that's the devaluing, is necessary. When somebody has something to offer that they don't have, this also stimulates envy because the goodness of the other person is recognized and they recognize that they have so much to give. But again, the feeling is that it's being withheld from them. Okay, so when you're on social media and you can now begin to understand why relationships need to appear as very ideal. See, because if they're not very ideal, if something even slightly, and it only takes something very small to puncture the idealization, the individual begins to feel as if something is being done to him. So it's not just a deprivation, it's an act of aggression. There's this old saying, which I may have mentioned in the first episode, there's no such thing as an absent caregiver. There is only a bad caregiver. Narcissistic individuals picture themselves in a mutually satisfactory, ideal relationship with the other, where the identity of each is not differentiated, a situation reminiscent of Freud's description of the oceanic feeling or Mahler's symbiotic stage of development. This is the narcissistic stage that I mentioned earlier. This is the first blissful time of life that gets recreated during this, what we call today, the love bombing stage. The other is the all-perfect other who will feed and take care of them, never frustrate them, never leave them, love them. And if they do something hurtful or destructive, the feeling and belief is, you should reassure me that it's okay. Everything is fine. Don't worry about it. We have to all pretend, right, that everything is fantastical and idyllic. But if we say anything, if somebody questions this hurtful behavior, that then begins the devaluing stage. So as I'm putting down all this foundation, you may be beginning to think, okay, so what hope is there? How do you actually help somebody like this? What would have to happen for improvement to occur? The omnipotent narcissism of the patient, of the individual, and all the aspects that I'm discussing here have to be laid bare. And now you're saying, wait, you just said, if you mention anything about this, it's going to lead to an intense devaluation. What would have to happen for improvement to occur? In order to protect the anonymity of my practice, I want to present a case as a composite of many experiences that I encounter in my practice. Here's this typical situation. In listening to this fellow, I could hear the depth of his narcissism, his lack of emotional contact with other people, and as a result, the lack of pleasure in his life, which made him envious of everybody else. Again, because they had things that he wants to have, but he knows he doesn't possess. That's the envy. He envied his wife, for instance, who he felt was far more capable than he was at enjoying relationships with people. He constantly projected his problems into her or other people and was unable to experience any hostile feelings as belonging to himself. In other words, he felt constantly under attack. Remember what I mentioned earlier, there's no such thing as an absent caregiver, only a bad caregiver. So he was constantly under attack. He enjoyed talking nonstop, and perhaps you know somebody like this. Perhaps he would take a break and wait to be acknowledged. Am I making myself clear? He might say, but only to get the yes, you are, sort of the pat on the back, and then he would continue forward. Any conflict, anxiety, or depression which emerged was so quickly discharged that it could barely be noticed. And this is what I meant earlier when I said these separations are so subtle that they go unnoticed. And because they go unnoticed, it's not uncommon to think that these individuals just quickly shift and they go from a sort of a pleasant, idealized relationship to a devaluing one, but something typically happens in between. He didn't share anything meaningful with his colleagues, he told me. There seemed to be an omnipotence, hiding hostility and envy, but it was so difficult to demonstrate any of this in the material. He deals with his fear of being rejected by me and others by approaching me, for instance, in a superior way, and rendering others and me as incapable. So here's a simple example. He complains about his colleagues at work and how they have inappropriate boundaries. When I explored this with him and I tried to get closer to it, what I began to understand is that his colleagues easily shared personal aspects of their lives with one another, and he couldn't do that. And therefore, he felt left out and, again, envious of what other people can do. As I worked with him in this area, he thought about how he does not share anything. He doesn't share anything personal with anyone. And I said to him, what do you imagine would happen? And he said they would change the topic and they would want to talk about something else. You see, and here is the beginning of what I was getting at earlier. This is the separation. This is the rejection. He's not using these words directly, at least not yet. What he's talking about is a fear of being ignored and then left alone. Here we can see that with the emergence of this being ignored, he feels rejected. And as I mentioned earlier, these individuals have an incredibly difficult time tolerating separation because the separation is a punishment. So to be more practical, what I would say with this fellow, there's a powerful resistance that's derived from his superior omnipotent attitude. That's the resistance to relating. And this denies him any need. In other words, when he relates in this way, he himself can deny any need of dependency and any anxiety that's related to him feeling dependent on anybody. So the rigid and all personality disorders, that's what, again, distinguishes them from the neurosis, is there's a certain level of rigidity. So the rigid preservation of the omnipotent narcissistic object relation blocks any progress. This type of individual, as you can hear, feels so endangered by any genuine contact with others and with any genuine contact with his psychic reality. In other words, what's going on inside of him. This is the type of fellow who would come in and say to me, after complaining, that he just wants me to give him the answers and tell him what to do and to give him advice. His prior therapist gave him advice. But in that way, you could see, and this is what I began to speak to him or talk to him about, is he wants me to function like a book. He could turn to a book, a self-help book, for instance, and get advice. So with that, just to push this simple example a little bit further, I began to talk to him about him seeing me like I'm just a book. And then this becomes the essential part of the treatment process, right? The way he relates to me. This is the omnipotent relating. He felt powerless and dependent and vulnerable. And to show his power over me, he needed to treat me like a nothing. Again, back to the title of this episode, he erases me. Now, I was able to talk to him about this way of relating to me, but I wasn't using the words like that I'm describing here with all of you. We don't talk about omnipotent narcissistic relating. Of course not. We stay very close to the surface in terms of what he's reporting. In episode one, I gave far more detail about the subjectively useful component and staying very close to the patient's experience and slowly exploring and trying to understand it and being curious and helping them become curious about their own behavior. And what eventually happened over time with this fellow is he expressed that this was scary and that he didn't think of himself as such an uncaring person. And he was very disappointed and upset with himself. And you could feel it. The mood shifted. The omnipotence disappears. And this is something, again, that I really want to emphasize, because in listening to other podcasts and exploring the social media that's out there, oftentimes I'm left with the impression that the narcissist is just a manipulative, controlling, lying, cheating individual. And it is true that there is a type of narcissism known as the malignant narcissist who does function in this way. But that's not the majority of narcissistic individuals, at least not in my experience. And here we can begin to see another side of this individual who actually does care. But we never would have seen that had we not pulled this to the fore. And if we weren't very sensitive to his sensitivities, to separation or vulnerability or dependence on me. So what do we do now? Because the work is not over when something like this is exposed. If it was that easy, I would be out of business, right? So what we need to do is appreciate, again, that the achievement of verbal thought has been a most unhappy event from the patient's perspective. In other words, he didn't verbally think of himself as somebody who's so uncaring, that he could treat somebody else like a book. He didn't think of himself that way. And now that he is thinking about it this way, he becomes upset. It's not pleasant. Verbal thought, right? Thinking of it this way is interwoven with the painful emotion of what? Loss, shame, humiliation, depression, that this individual, this kind of patient, has spent his whole life trying to avoid, right? That's the whole point of the omnipotent narcissistic object relation, is to split off and deny all these painful feelings. So it is at these moments that I would concentrate on not allowing this kind of patient for a single moment to retreat, either from his realization that he's ruthless or from his hatred of me for bringing him to this emotional realization of the fact that, you know, that this is what, like I said before, he spent his whole life trying to evade this awareness. So of course he's going to get angry with me and devalue me. He doesn't want to hear this. And this is what typically happens, is I say at these moments that I will continue, that I won't allow him to retreat. But because this is a process, the moments of clarity occur over time more frequently. So in other words, initially, these moments of clarity, when he bumps into these painful realizations, are fleeting. But eventually, as I can continue to bring them to the fore, they stay longer, and it happens more often. And he lasts longer in this state, what I would call a more reflective state. But there's always this back and forth. And that's why treatment, someone asked me this question just recently, or they made it more like a statement that this is going to take time. And I was like, you're damn right. This takes time and patience because these are personality disorders. That means that there's something so deeply entrenched in the personality. It's like a structure, and structural change takes time. It's a process. Things don't happen quickly. And it's so necessary to go over this from many different perspectives and to go over it. And then it comes and it goes, but it continues to expand and get richer and deeper. So often the attempt at integration, right? Integrating these different sides of his personality, they fail. They fail because mechanisms related to the omnipotent narcissistic self suddenly take over control again, right? They take over the control of the more realistic self. And it's an attempt to divert or expel the painful recognition of what? All the things I've been mentioning already, the dependency, the envious feelings, and the idea that someone is attacking them. Remember, I said that too, that this is bad. If they depend on you, they're going to be frustrated and attacked. To bring about improvement, these are the things that have to happen. So what's the prognosis? The prognosis depends on the degree to which the patient is able to acknowledge. Like, in other words, there needs to be a recognition of dependency, inevitable separations and frustrations, and a working through of this loss. And it's a real big loss, by the way, because what's the biggest loss? The loss is of the structure of the omnipotent way of relating. According to this one particular theory, here's the bottom line. If I can just overly simplify everything that we've been talking about in these last two episodes, increasing integration is key. These two sides of the personality that I'm describing. As these individuals that I mentioned throughout both episodes, as they progress, they become more aware of themselves as a whole person. As the object, and in other words, they become more aware of all different feelings inside of themselves. So they become more of a whole person. Simultaneously, they begin to relate to the people in their lives as whole objects. Remember I said earlier, the narcissistic way of relating is to part objects, need gratifying objects. But when things go accordingly and this integration occurs, now they begin to relate to themselves and others as a more complete person. And such experiences of guilt and loss bring pain. But this is a developmental achievement. There's an old saying, which you may have heard of, no pain, no gain, right? That may be more of a gym reference, but I think you see what I mean. Stated differently, they begin to care about someone, which is a quite remarkable achievement for the narcissistic patient, for the narcissistic individual. As they tolerate, and they do, they begin to tolerate ambivalence, and that's critical. And there is no such thing, they begin to recognize this, that there is no such thing as the perfect analyst, the perfect partner, the one who's constantly attentive and maybe not a little preoccupied from time to time. So there's no such thing as the perfect other or the perfect self. And if they begin to believe that and feel that, then there's less of a need to retreat to the world of narcissistic object relating. One final note, it's crucial to understand that the transformation that I'm describing, this is a common occurrence in my practice and in the field of psychoanalysis. It doesn't stem from merely explaining or educating someone about how relationships work. In other words, you can't teach somebody these qualities. That's why seeking professional help is strongly recommended if you or someone you know is navigating this kind of relationship. In particular, consulting with an experienced professional who has, you know, experience in working with narcissistic individuals is strongly advised. That's one thing that I do hear quite commonly in my review of the social media content, and that is something I agree with. As demonstrated in the earlier example, successful intervention with these individuals is really challenging because they devalue you. And it takes a lot of, as I described, curiosity, containing, detoxifying the aggression, and all the other things that I described that are necessary to help them form a more integrated sense of self. This process is challenging and time-consuming. But, of course, and again, you may call me overly optimistic or Pollyannish, but in my own experience, narcissistic patients change. And I emphasize that because so frequently I hear that these are not individuals who will ever change. Regrettably, we must conclude our discussion here for now. As always, there's so much more to say. Remember, this is just one theoretical perspective. There are many different perspectives on the narcissistic way of relating, and I'll get into more of that as we go along in this podcast. But for now, if there's anything that I said that confused you, because this stuff is quite complicated, please feel free to reach out. I love getting questions and talking about this stuff. This topic is undeniably complex, so feel free to send me an email. But until next time, engage your mind. Disclaimer alert. The Narcissism Dakota podcast is provided for general information purposes only. The content presented in this podcast is not intended to diagnose, treat, or cure any psychological condition related to narcissism. The content on this podcast should not be considered a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. For specific advice pertaining to narcissism or any other psychological condition, you could reach me directly. I am an experienced mental health practitioner who is always taking on new patients. If you would just like a consultation, I can do that too.